From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. If you are a regular listener, you know this is when we get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this last week here in our region. Quite a bit to get to today, and our panel includes Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer Ian Mack Stevenson, also with the Idaho Statesman, and Andrea Olson with EastIdahoNews.com. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
So, Ian, I'd like to start with you, and let's talk about the latest from Boise City Council. This is in regards to a former city council member, Lisa Sanchez. She wants her seat back. So, for folks who have not been following this, can you quickly just give us a synopsis of why there's this situation and then what's going on right now?
Yes. So Lisa Sanchez, who was elected to her second term on the council in 2021, moved to a new apartment in January of this year. And a few days later at a council meeting, the council discovered that the place that she had moved was outside of her district, District 3, which covers the North End and Northwest Boise. And so the city attorneys basically concluded that because she had moved out of her district, even though it was unintentional, she therefore lost her seat. Lisa Sanchez followed up on that by quickly moving back into her district. She only ended up living out of it for a number of days. And then she reapplied to the mayor to be reappointed, or rather to be appointed to the seat. But earlier this month, Mayor Lauren McLean decided, instead of appointing Lisa Sanchez, to appoint someone else to fill the seat for the remainder of the term. She picked LaTanya Haney-Keith, who is now serving in that seat and will until after the November elections. But as a result, right after Mayor Lauren McLean announced that appointment, Lisa Sanchez filed a lawsuit against the city, arguing that she had been, the city had been unjustified in removing her, that it didn't have the authority to remove her. And most recently, her attorney, Wendy Olson, has requested that a judge file a preliminary injunction against the city and require her to be placed back in her seat and to declare that the council member who replaced her, Haney Keith, is void. So there was a hearing on that matter a couple of days ago, and sometime today, perhaps on Monday, a judge is going to rule on whether or not to issue that preliminary injunction.
Okay, so we're just waiting to hear what the judge's decision is on this and if she could potentially be placed back in that position, if I'm understanding this correctly.
Yes, and it's a rather extraordinary situation, I would say. If the judge ends up siding with her, that could mean that it could call into question what the city council has been doing over the past few months, because it would basically mean that the council member who's replaced Lisa Sanchez is not legitimate, and therefore the decisions they've made could be problematic. So it would basically be the court deciding that she needs to have her seat back, at least for the time being.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the update on that. Kevin, we know that there is a mental health crisis in our country. I mean, right here in Idaho, we know that very well. And we're talking in particular when it comes to youth. You wrote a really interesting story recently because we actually don't know how bad this crisis is. And Kevin, that's because we just don't have the data, correct?
Well, yes, Gemma. It was fairly alarming panel discussion at the State Board of Education meeting on Tuesday. And it came kind of towards the end of a full day of meetings and presentations. We heard from several higher education administrators who said, we know that we're seeing more students coming into seek counseling on the college campuses. We know the caseload numbers are up. We also know that the number of really severe cases, students in crisis mode, that's increasing. The counselors are really overwhelmed by students who are depressed or considering taking their lives. What we don't know, according to the panel, is we don't have any really clear baseline of data that you can compare institution to institution. And we don't have a really good baseline to try to get a sense of what's happening before students go to college. I mean, you know, we don't have a really good baseline that views this as it really is. So it's a K through 20 mental health issue. Mm-hmm. What we did hear on Tuesday, the numbers that we did hear are pretty astounding. I mean, Boise State University and Lewis Clark State College have both basically said that their counseling appointments have doubled over the past 4 or 5 years. Idaho State University says that their caseload is increasing, and this is an amazing, really kind of stark number. They said that of the students who came in seeking counseling during fall semester last year, more than 43% of these students said they had seriously considered suicide. 43%. Wow. So
wow.
We know two things are happening, more cases and more severe cases, but we don't have a lot of data. And it's going to be hard to put all that data together, Gemma, for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's a big task to try to track this at the higher education level. It's going to be even tougher to track this at the K-12 level for a lot of reasons, including the parental rights movement. We had a parental rights law go into effect that essentially allows parents to determine whether they want their students to take behavioral surveys or health surveys, which have come under fire at the K-12 level in the past few years anyway. It's just going to be really difficult to track how bad this problem is, but pretty clear from what we heard in that short presentation on Tuesday, it's a crisis and it's not getting better.
So, Kevin, how does COVID play into this? And I ask that question because I think that there is this idea, and I think that there's probably some truth to it, that having gone through COVID, right, and a lot of these students in particular who are in college now had their high school experience explode, basically. And yeah. and they are probably still, I think, reeling in a lot of ways socially, emotionally from that. But you mentioned that these numbers have been increasing over the last 4 to 5 years. Well, COVID started 3 years ago.
Right. And the numbers were increasing even before that real surge we've seen in the past 4 to 5 years. What the panel said is, or what at least one of the panelists said is, you know, it's not just the pandemic. The pandemic mm-hmm. definitely made things worse, but it's not all pandemic. There are a lot of other factors at play here. It's, you know, smartphones, social media, there are a lot of things that are factoring into this. So pinning it all on the pandemic would be an oversimplification.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's a good point, right? With social media and having all of this access right at your fingertips, because this really is the first generation who grew up in this age of social media. And as a mom myself, I've always said, I think there are benefits to it. And there are detriments to it, but it's probably too soon in a way to probably have really in-depth studies and research on the implications of it.
Exactly. And one of the panelists, I think it was one of the administrators from Idaho State University, as I recall, said the problem with technology and the problem with social media is that it's connection, but it's not real connection. So it doesn't really connect young people with other young people or with other people. And it's the illusion of connection. And sometimes that doesn't really, really work. And sometimes it actually creates a negative, you know, this, you know, a young mm-hmm. person takes a selfie, posts it and waits to see how many likes he or she gets. And if the likes don't come in like they're hoping it, they will, then it's a negative experience. Mm-hmm.
So any actionable items then from this meeting, Kevin, or is it just more like we have an issue, we need to maybe dig deeper into this?
I think the state board realizes that it's a problem that they're going to have to spend more time on, but it's going to take a real sort of calibration of time and energy, I think, at the state board level. I mean, the state board talks about a lot of education metrics, and they talked about a lot of education metrics on Tuesday and Wednesday. I mean, it's what they do when they get together. They talk about how we're funding schools, how we're carving up state funding. You know, what are reading scores looking like? What are go-on rates looking like? You know, what are absentee rates looking like? We measure everything in education. So And that's sort of the state board's world, is to look at those numbers and try to figure out what that means in terms of policy. I think it's going to require them spending a lot more time looking at what data they can get about mental health issues in the K-20 system and try to figure out what sort of policy needs to follow it. It's tough because, you know, some of the policy decisions that are being made at the state level really can run counter to trying to address mental health. I mean, another example from this panel discussion, Idaho State's counseling director said, mm-hmm. we're trying to do a lot of student events. Now, and these aren't just throwing parties for students. It's trying to help students figure out where they belong and try to help them fit in on campus. Well, that sounds great, except that at the state level, those kind of activities, when they become an inclusion activity, run afoul of legislators who say we don't want to put money into diversity and equity and inclusion because that's a bad thing. So it kind of, our policies sometimes at the state level don't always mesh with the messaging that you hear about, well, you know, we want to address mental health. We want to get a handle on the mental health crisis. So state board's got a lot of work ahead of it.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it. Andrea, I want to bring you into the conversation. Let's head over to Eastern Idaho where you are, because it's a disturbing story coming out of Idaho Falls. A therapist admitted to abusing vulnerable adults?
Yes, that story was quite popular over here. Actually, I was looking through court documents. He's 64 years old. His name is Robert Stan. Actually, very many people know him, and some of our reporters have previously interviewed him as an expert for some of the stories that we've done on mental health. So this was quite shocking when we learned about this. He is the founder of Wellspring Counseling in Idaho Falls, and he was charged with felony sexual abuse or exploitation of a vulnerable adult. And so what essentially happened is that he ended up writing a letter admitting some of the things that he has done and shared it with a woman and provided a copy to that woman. And in the letter, he talks about the abuse that happened between March 2021 and June 2021. So in the letter, he talked about two vulnerable adults where he had cared for them for several years. It was unclear as to where he was caring for them. It may have been in his house. I talked to other people who have known him and said that he cared for vulnerable adults at his house. But the adults both were nonverbal and had the mentality of 18 months old. And so he admitted in the letter that one of the victims was like a sexual object to him, in which he could be aroused. He admitted to watching her naked as she was changing her clothes. He also created scenarios where he could see the victim in various states of, you know, undressing. And then he said in the letter, according to the affidavit, I did this approximately six times downstairs in order for me to feel sexual thrill. So then when the detective spoke with this man, he confirmed he had written the letter and committed the acts. So yeah, that's what basically happened. But the charge that he's facing is punishable by up to 25 years in prison and a $25,000 fine and restitution. And then he appeared in court earlier this week and was given a $15,000 bond. So
and he has another hearing coming up soon, correct?
Yes, he has a preliminary hearing on May 9th at 1 p.m. So that should be interesting. Sometimes people waive their preliminary hearings, but when they don't waive them, that's usually when more information comes out about the incidents. So if he doesn't waive it, that is something that we would probably go to and learn more about what specifically happened.
Okay. So Kevin and Brian, I know you have both been following what's been going on at North Idaho College. Kevin, I want to start with you. Now, first, would you give us some background on this in case folks are not familiar and what's going on now? Because Frankly, I think this is really difficult to follow because there has been so much that continues to happen.
Do you want to clear off the next hour block here? And
I know, right?
Let Brian and I riff on this. It's such a long story, but here's where we're at. This week, you've got a creditor is back at North Idaho College, and they're doing a site visit. And that's really the most important thing that's going on at North Idaho College this week, in my view, because these accreditors may decide whether to pull North Idaho College's accreditation. And that really affects students. If NIC loses its accreditation, which appears to be a really distinct possibility at this point, students won't be able to get financial aid. They won't be able to get state opportunity scholarships. I believe they won't be able to get federal Pell Grants. And you can't transfer credits from an unaccredited institution. So if you're going to NIC to get your associate's degree and you're hoping to go to University of Idaho or Boise State or what have you, or if you're a high school kid, which may be, it may include high school kids in the Treasure Valley, you know, theoretically, taking a class through NIC, well, you know, great, but you won't be able to take those credits and move them from an unaccredited school into a two-year college or a four-year college. So it is a big mess when you start to talk about loss of accreditation. So that's the important thing to keep in mind as we mm-hmm. get into all of the machinations that have been going on this week, and Brian's written about that as well. The long and the short of it is, this week, trustees declared President Nick Swain's contract null and void. And this contract has been in dispute now for several months. It doesn't mean that Swain has been fired. It doesn't mean that he has been pulled off of the job again, which happened back in December and took a court order to get him reinstated. It means that the contract is null and void and he is still on the job until trustees decide otherwise, whatever that means. The college has now hired a new attorney. This came a day after their former attorney or soon to be former attorney, Art Mockenberg, who had run for attorney general last year, issued a lengthy report about the Swain contract and the process of hiring Swain. And again, go back to the accreditation issue. Keep your eye on the ball on accreditation here. One of the key issues about North Idaho College's accreditation, one of the things that's caught the eye of the regional panel that oversees accreditation is all of this churn at the top at NIC, all of this churn within the administration. Well, you have still more uncertainty about who's president at North Idaho College next week, next month, next year. What did I miss, Brian?
Okay. Yeah. And so, Brian, I want to bring you into this because, you know, you've written an opinion piece on this basically saying that, I mean, and this does come down to, as Kevin said, a lot of jostling at the top to get certain people in these seats of power. But now that they're there, here we are with the possibility of this college losing their accreditation.
Yeah, and it's precisely because of the jostling at the top that the college is in at risk of losing its accreditation. That's been the there haven't been substantive issues raised by the accrediting body with the quality of instruction or things like that. The issue has been bad governance, bad conduct by the board. The meetings this week were further examples of that, as nullifying the contract of President Swain is quite likely to be seen as defiance of a court order, and it's just been sort of fiasco after fiasco. Now the longer term background of this is that the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee, and as Daniel Walters of the Inlander has reported, they received some help from David Riley, sort of a rabid anti-Semite who was one of the organizers of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, really worked hard to get a far right majority who had not historically been involved with the college onto the board of trustees, and so that sort of effort to get those people onto the board has been quite successful. But the thing that's striking when you step back and look is that they haven't successfully you know, executed some plan to turn this into like a far right teaching organization or anything like that. It's just crumbling. And so it really, in my view, gives a broader lesson about the state of the far right right now, which is that they do show some promise at campaigning. They've been very effective getting people on this board, but once they're there, they have no idea what to do. And it's just a fiasco.
Right.
And I think it goes back
to the accreditation issue has very little to do with what's happening in the classroom. I mean, you think about a college that's in danger of losing its accreditation, your assumption would be, wow, they have unqualified teachers. They have too few teachers and too many students. They have awful facilities that can't accommodate and provide a modern quality education to students. None of that has come up in the accreditation debate at all. So you have faculty and staff that are, you know, as far as the accreditation process goes, I've heard and seen nothing to suggest that they're not doing a decent job. And they're kind of stuck in the middle of this fight over accreditation, which is a fight over governance.
So, Kevin, with that said, do we have any idea then when this group who's come in, this accreditation panel, when and if they will make a decision? And I'll tell you what, if I were a student there or I had a kid there, I would be livid right now. I mean, have we heard from anyone who's getting instruction there?
We've got two things going on here. So June is probably the soonest we will get any kind of decision from the accrediting body. But the point you're making, Gemma, is spot on, and we're seeing it already. You know, North Idaho College has struggled with enrollment for years, and a lot of community colleges have struggled all across the country, but North Idaho College has really struggled with enrollment at a time when Kootenai County is growing like gangbusters. They're not bringing in students, and you've got to think that a part of that is parents and students saying, why am I going to spend money going to this college not knowing what its future is? So you have people voting with their feet.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that makes perfect sense. Ian, let's switch gears and talk about the fact that you got to spend your evening yesterday at a Boise Planning and Zoning meeting. Thank you for doing that so other people did not have to. But in all seriousness, I mean, a lot going on there and really necessary to be covering this. And that is because this was the last meeting before Planning and Zoning make a recommendation to Boise City Council about rezoning parts of the city. Can you walk us through this? And because this is a hot button issue, there are folks very adamant on both sides of this issue.
Yeah, so the Boise Planning and Zoning Commission held several nights of hours-long hearings this week. And on this topic, they took a lot of public testimony. Over 100 people testified, a bunch of neighborhood associations. And what they're talking about, the subject of these hearings, is a years-long process that the city has gone through to overhaul its zoning code. And to just sort of remind people about zoning laws are basically the rules and regulations that govern what sorts of buildings are allowed to be built in different parts of the city. So it can seem a little dry, I think, but it's really important to a city's future and thinking about what it will look like down the road. And so the city's been working on this plan for about 3 years, even longer by some measures if you account for other things. But the changes that are in this proposed code are basically incentives for affordable housing and sustainability in a lot of the residential areas of the city. So it could be easier for in single family neighborhoods like the North End, it could be easier to build slightly larger buildings like triplexes and fourplexes, so long as there are a number of those units that are marked as affordable and rented as affordable. There also would be new mixed use districts along transit corridors. So think of State Street, where there's a lot of investment going into improving bus service there. The city wants to see, instead of sort of commercial areas with surface parking lots, they want to see larger buildings with mixes of first floor retail and apartment buildings on top, more pedestrian and bike friendly sort of urban environments. And also there are going to be some changes to the public hearing process for certain applications, sort of streamlining some of that from the developer perspective. So this process has gotten a lot of feedback from the public. As I said, there were close to around 140 people testified. And we can go into sort of what the comments are from the public, but ultimately what the commission decided was they're going to recommend approval of that code rewrite. So it'll go to city council in June and they'll decide whether to make it into law.
Mm-hmm. I am curious, Ian, about what some folks did testify to, because I don't want to oversimplify this issue, but I mean, kind of what it comes down to, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is it's kind of sprawl versus like building up, right? With building being more compacted. And a lot of people don't want to see, you know, some people want to see that, and some people want to frankly see more of the sprawl, so that we don't become this big, huge urban area.
Right. I think that's fair. Basically, the existing code, while there have been some changes over the decades, most of it dates from the 1960s, and as do a lot of codes around the country that were put in place in growing cities. And what we've seen over the years is that because of some of the limitations on growing upwards, the city is sort of sprawled out. And so there's lots of building sort of in the further reaches of Boise. And the mayor and the city's planning director, Tim Keene, they really want to change that pattern for a number of reasons. One is that they want to protect the remaining open space that exists around the city. They don't want to see subdivisions going up further and further outside of city limits. Another reason is that the city has a lot of climate change priorities, getting to clean power and renewable energy. And they say that in order to design a city that works for public transit, where you can have a functioning bus system, perhaps trains, a place that's more bikeable where people can walk, the idea is that you need to have people living closer to services, people living closer to downtown or where they work or where they go to school, so they don't have to drive as much, or if they do have to drive, it's for shorter distances. And also the city is really trying to tackle what it views as a housing affordability crisis. There's so many people, as we've heard over the last few years during COVID and even before that, having trouble affording rents. And the city thinks that part of that is because there just aren't enough units being built. And so by allowing more density, more apartments, their hope is that this will sort of incentivize more of those to be built and will result in more units for people and hopefully bring some of the prices down. Now, on the other side of this, there are a lot of people who sort of have mobilized against it. There's a group called Reject Boise Upzone. And I'd say they sort of have a number of different angles on this, but some of the main issues that they've identified are, for one thing, a lot of people like the neighborhoods where they live, right? They they live in a part of town, they bought a house there, they moved there because they like that it's single family, they like that it's quiet, they like that it doesn't have taller buildings, and they want it to stay that way. They sort of view that as part of the character of the neighborhood. So that's been a big argument. Some people also have had concerns that this will result in teardowns of older homes. For instance, because of some of the incentives in residential areas, it could mean that maybe a smaller, modest house could get torn down and someone might put up a fancier duplex in place of it. There was a number of people who made that argument. The city, though, has said in response to that's actually, a lot of that is happening now. People can tear down some more modest homes and put up larger, more expensive homes. But yeah, there's been a lot of debate from both sides on what the sort of best path forward is for the city.
Mm-hmm. All right. Andrea, there was a devastating fire at Highlands High School in Pocatello last weekend. So what is the latest with this, and what's going on in terms of how and where students will be able to finish the school year?
Yeah. So on Friday, April 21st, I remember coming into the newsroom and there was an early morning fire at Highland High School, and it was over in the D building. which is the band and choir rooms, cafeteria, and the school's gymnasium. And this fire broke out about like 4 a.m. on Friday and destroyed those rooms. And so this was very devastating to a lot of people. Obviously, there was no school that day. And so there's been a lot of talks as to what's going to happen for the rest of the school year. And in a unanimous vote, the Pocatello and Chubbuck School District Board of Trustees approved a plan to return to in-person instruction for Highland High School, but by using Century High School's facilities to finish out the school year. So the Century High School learners will attend school in person on Mondays and Wednesdays and Fridays, with remote learning days scheduled on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then as for the Highland High School learners, they will attend school in person at Century High School on Tuesdays and Thursdays, with remote learning scheduled on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. So they're kind of going back and forth, but that's what they decided to do to finish out the school year, as the school comes to terms with what's going on and figure out what to do next.
So, I mean, they only have about a month left of school. It's not that long. So I can understand this solution. I'm sure there are parents and students not too happy to have to do remote learning again. With that said, though, Andrea, what happens in the fall? I mean, you know, school starts back up mid-August. Do they have any plan or idea yet?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And I think they're still trying to figure that out. I know they're trying to figure out transportation as well. I think this is still kind of up in the air with trying to figure out what's going to go on. They're calling this a tragedy because obviously the school has been around for so long. And I know there's fundraisers out there for the school. But yeah, right now they're trying to figure out what to do for the fall. I think they're taking one day at a time.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, that is a lot to have to figure out, and frankly, a very short amount of time. Kevin, I want to talk about the library bill that was vetoed by Governor Little, which a lot of this was because Idahoans really rallied in force around this, saying we don't want this bill to come into law. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. This isn't the end of that fight. This will likely come back next legislative session, I would assume. So if you could talk to us a little bit about this. I know you recently wrote about it, and I've only got about 2.5 minutes left with you.
Okay. Well, I was curious to see what was going on within the governor's office in the 2 weeks leading up to his veto of the library bill. And this was the bill that would have banned libraries from providing harmful materials, however you define harmful materials, to minors, and would have allowed parents to seek fines against libraries that violated this law. So what I wanted to find out was, what was the governor's office hearing? And I filed a public records request to get the emails. And close to 2,000 emails from people urging the governor to veto that bill. By comparison, I think there were 49, by my account, people who emailed the governor urging him to sign the bill. So very, very lopsided public outcry here on the bill. Now, the governor's office also received telephone calls, and those were a little bit more of an even split between supporters and opponents. I also wanted to get a sense of what people were saying, because as you said, this is not an issue that's going to go away anytime soon. I think everybody recognizes that there will be another attempt to address objectionable materials, harmful materials, however you want to define that, in libraries. In an election year where 105 legislative seats are up for grabs, this is certainly going to come back next session.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's what we're looking at then, is what could happen next session. But I have to say, Kevin, that, as you said, that is a big difference in people urging the governor to veto this versus, you know, other people. So yeah, definitely looking to see what happens next session.
And let's be fair. I mean, some of those numbers are kind of skewed. I mean, there are definitely orchestrated attempts to get people to send emails. One actually came through an outfit that's based in Australia. So this stuff does happen, but it does also reflect these are people who took the time to at least do that and
right.
Go through a third party and kind of submit a form email urging the governor to veto the bill. So, obviously this legislation struck a nerve with a lot of Idahoans, and that's kind of what I was trying to get a handle on with this story.
Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Of course, our panelists, once again, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, Brian Clark and Ian Mac Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, and Andrea Olson with EastIdahoNews.com. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
What if the greatest tragedy of your life was just covered up?
I have never seen anything like that before or after.
This is the story of the worst marine-on-marine friendly fire in modern history, a story kept from the public.
It's like, what did y'all have to hide?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast in its latest series, Taking Cover.